Reader's Footnotes. We thank you for coming and joining us. As you know, we've completed kind of our tour of the art of games, and so we're going to move on to some other subjects. We hope you'll stick with us. If you have any ideas for show topics or things that you think would be particularly well-suited to semi-pretentious thoughts, please go ahead and drop us an email at gamersfootnotes@gmail.com. That's two S's, gamersfootnotes@gmail.com. But enough self-promotion. We've got a great show today. We're going to talk a little bit about why games tend to not do great in other media, sort of the concept of games. Obviously, we enjoy games. We talk about them a lot enough to do this podcast. Why don't they tend to translate? What are the successes? And how do they sort of highlight the failures in how these games sort of interact with other forms of traditional media? We're then going to transition a little bit and talk. My illustrious co-host is going to talk a little bit about gaming conventions here in the wake of GamersCon. And I'm going to discuss soundtracks in games a little bit. Now that we've looked at art, we can look at specific applications of art and sort of, BGM soundtracks and other things that you might get in pre-order bonuses. And you're starting to see a lot more offered as separate things, even on Steam, as individual downloads.
And I think one of the best things to start with in looking at why games tend to fail in other media is just to jump in with examples. And one of the best examples I can see is Final Fantasy constantly attempts to become a movie. They released a real movie, The Spirits Within, and it was okay.
Had real actors in it, fairly well-known actors. I'm pretty sure Alec Baldwin played the main character, though.
Yeah, I think it was Alec Baldwin was in it, and Ben Affleck was in it.
Ben Affleck. Oh, well, and, James Woods. James Woods was the villain. Fantastic performance, favorite character in the movie. But like you said, it was okay.
Right. It's strictly okay, and it's one of those things that's, if you would pick a gaming franchise to make that leap, Final Fantasy has often been the most cinematic of games, has very well-developed cutscenes, and generally has compelling stories, or at least enough motivation to continue to grind your way up through levels. But yet, when you look at The Spirits Within, when you look at Advent Children, the stories just tend to fall apart. And part of it makes me wonder if where it falls down is you don't have that emotional investment. That in a Final Fantasy story, you, through the controller, are tied into the actions of the characters. Whereas when you're watching a movie, you're just a third person observing the events, that you don't feel like you have any influence on the events per se.
And as we talked about some in previous episodes, a lot of what makes games work is the visceral emotional reaction that you can have. Again, going to the most popular example right now, The Last of Us, I don't think it works as well as a movie. I think you need sort of that emotional impact. The Walking Dead, I think, while it clearly works as a comic book, I think that the specific story they were trying to tell worked very, very well with the interactive components. And when you take those out, a lot of times you're going to lose something of the experience. Sometimes you can kind of go the other way. The gameplay sort of covers up flaws in the story. You don't think about it because you're distracted by, oh, I've got to collect 15 wolf spleens or whatever it is you're doing. And sometimes, or something much cooler, sometimes that can sort of cover up the gaps in the story because you're not focusing on plot holes the way you would with a movie. With a movie, the most recent Star Trek movie, I enjoyed it because it was pretty distracting, but then as I was thinking about it later, I kept going through and thinking, yeah, that doesn't make any sense, that doesn't make any sense, that doesn't make any sense, that's not how the character would react, that doesn't make any sense. And games, I think, have a unique position in that you're even more likely to be able to pick it apart because you're missing sort of that glue that would have bound everything together and distracted you just enough, been the misdirection that would cause you not to think about it. My example, game I love dearly, the Xenosaga series. If you actually sit down and try to map out the whole thing, there are some plot holes. There are some things that really don't actually make any sense. But this is over the course of, I have never bothered to total up, but probably 70-hour, 90-hour, some bizarre number of hour adventure. You don't notice the things that don't quite match up, that Wilhelm is a little bit inconsistent, that, you know, there are things that you are covered up by the gameplay. And so that's sort of my kind of initial take on why these things sort of wouldn't translate to other media.
And I think Xenosaga is a great example because I played the first Xenosaga and sat through the cutscenes and remembered just flat out enjoying them and thought they were nice breakups between the gameplay and then as part of the pre-order for the second game, you got a DVD of all the cutscenes together.
Something kind like of, 8 hours.
Yeah, 8 hours of the cutscenes cut together to be a movie, and I've never been able to sit through it.
Because in a game, you're also expected to take breaks, and so in some sense, games are closer to TV shows. You may play for longer than a half an hour. Yeah, I certainly have been known to binge, but you can and are encouraged in some sense to take it as episodes, even if you want to look at it as from save point to save point as one episode. And so, especially with the transition to movies, games sort of are designed, and the stories that games tell are sort of designed around a semi-episodic nature. And I think that also can hurt their transition to movies. Also, games tend to tell much grander stories. A lot of times they don't fit in an hour and a half, and so you have to do a series, and generally the will isn't there to do a series about a game because you don't want to make a movie that you're not sure is going to make money. And so there are a lot of things sort of working against the experience that you tell in games. Again, Final Fantasy should work because Final Fantasy already tells a different story with each installment. And so it would be maybe a little bit more prone than some games to being turned into a movie. And yet, even then, it still just doesn't seem to quite click.
And one of the things that I think is always unique about Final Fantasy, and I'm going to focus now on Advent Children, is in the game Final Fantasy VII, you got to make a lot of decisions about your characters. And you got to, I mean, you could change their names, starting in something very basic. But you got to make a lot of decisions on how you chose to view any of the given characters. Are you sympathetic to Cloud? Are you antagonistic to Cloud? Are you sympathetic to Barrett? Are you antagonistic to Barrett? Do you help Vincent discover, you know, his past? Do you choose not to help Vincent discover his past? Do you choose to help Sid? Do you not choose to help Sid? And your emotional investment into the characters is pretty arbitrary and very subjective to you, the viewer. So you can focus on the storylines that interest you. But then conversely, when you're watching Advent Children, the creators have to take a position on the characters. They have to say, this is how we want you to feel about Cloud. This is how we want you to feel about Tifa. This is how we want you to feel about Vincent. And those choices they make are may not be the same choices you, the game player, have already made about how you feel about these characters. And so then the depictions fall flat, and you can't ever get that thought out of your mind. This is not how I think the characters are.
And you see a lot of that in manga and books that deal with, or anything that deals with, a open-ended character. And the examples I'm going to use here are the Persona games, Persona 3 and Persona 4 especially. In both games, you are the protagonist, and you name him, and the Persona games, for those who aren't aware of them, incorporate sort of an aspect of social sim, in that you choose how you spend your time each day before you go into an alternate world to fight things at night. And so, in other words, you really are developing your character, developing his relationships, and doing this and that. And the thing is, when transition, there is a canon character, because for the books, for the manga, there has to be one guy with a name. And that's always a little bit jarring, because he may or may not in any way represent, in the game, your protagonist is very silent, doesn't say a lot. And when you make the transition to books, of course, he's talking and he's doing things. He's not really you anymore, and so it completely removes you from the game. And so at least and I, of course, represent a Western audience, and these are Japanese games and Japanese books. And the books aren't bad. It's not a failure necessarily of literature or of the writing for the game. The story is very good, but it's a completely different experience, and not just because it's different, not just in how the story develops. The story develops along very similar lines. It's completely different in how you are related to the experience, because you're truly just an outside observer with the book, whereas you are the character and the driving force in the game. And so even when games work in other media, they're no longer properly considered. They may share a name, but they might as well not. It is a connection only through name. The experience is so vastly different that you're not really seeing a game succeed in another narrative. You're seeing the story that was used for a game told in another medium as a completely separate object. And all that really proves is that the story was good enough that it could have been written as a graphic novel, not that the game has really in any sense transitioned, because the game hasn't. Of course, you can't necessarily, you know, we have interactive books, we have Choose Your Own Adventure and things like that, so there are ways to do that, but that's not what happens. You see the story taken out and cut away from everything, and it's really, I think, appropriately viewed as an entirely separate entity than it is as a game succeeding in another media.
And kind of diving down into that point and drilling a little deeper, one of the video game properties that people often ask for a movie for is Half-Life, because Half-Life and Half-Life 2 tell a very compelling story. But here's the fundamental problem. Gordon Freeman has never spoken. And if you have a movie, you can't really have the central character not ever say anything. And the question then becomes, as soon as Gordon Freeman speaks, 90% of the people are going to hate it. 99% of the people are going to hate it, because it's not how he sounds, because he is you. And Half-Life does a really good job of making his thoughts really are your own thoughts on how you choose. I mean, it really presents these characters for you to pass your own moral judgments on, however you choose to see fit. But in a movie, the movie director has to, in a way, pass his own moral judgments. And I think that's one of the reasons why you'll never see a Half-Life movie, or you can never see a Half-Life book, or you can never really see any exploration in Half-Life, because it's so connected to how you, the person, view it. And the same thing with Portal. I mean, the second Chell speaks, it's going to break the immersion, even though that's something we've often asked for. But however you view GLaDOS may not be how a third person writing Chell would view GLaDOS. And then at that point, you've already created a fundamental disconnect with the audience, because they don't have that same shared expectation. And part of the reason why movies work is they tend to convey things of which people have a shared expectation to. So World War II movies, for instance, which we're seeing sort of a resurgence of, the idea that war is hell is something that's universal through humanity. It's something that people have discussed constantly. And as long as the movie's sort of portraying that, everybody can get on board. But if a movie tried to make war seem like this wonderful grand thing, you would just see tons of pushback.
I tend to agree. And so you see that, and on that same line, a lot of these preconceptions we have about our characters, you'd say, well, you see newer games sometimes try to avoid that. I'm going to use Dragon's Age 1 and Dragon's Age 2. Dragon's Age 1, you could create your character, but of course that led to all the problems we've just talked about in terms of, well, in that one you could be different races, different backgrounds, and it created the whole point of the game, in my opinion, was to explore those different backgrounds and how different people would interact, to explore the prejudices that and how societies interact.
And that's a good point, because in Dragon Age 1, a lot of the experience was how those backgrounds and different races led you to different conclusions and resolutions of the plot.
Exactly. The different plot lines. You were treated very differently in the Dwarven City if you had left there. Well, even that one's an interesting one, because even the two different dwarves got vastly different receptions when they returned. Much less so if you were a completely different race. And so you got to kind of explore these. And the game worked fantastically as that kind of an experience, as an experience to sort of explore these greater concepts of prejudice and race. And, you know, we always say, oh, yeah, everyone will band together when there's a great enough threat. Well, will they? How immediate does the threat have to be before that becomes an issue? And so the game functioned great for that. The problem is you can't really talk about it in any other media, because you would have to pick one of those characters to be the correct one. We see this with KOTOR 1 and KOTOR 2, where there are canon characters, especially KOTOR 2. It doesn't work super well, but they exist. KOTOR, Knights of the Old Republic, for any listeners who are not familiar with that series, Star Wars game. They eventually established the two main characters, who I'm not going to discuss because of plot reasons, but eventually, in the second game, you could be anyone, and they had to establish you as one person. Same thing as Dragon's Age 1. This becomes a problem. In Dragon's Age 2, they decided to have a fixed character. And they did an okay job with it. There were still a lot of ways you could take him. There was a lot of choice in the game. But I can't help but think that part of this is they wanted to be able to discuss the story down the road, because they're thinking sequels. Not even just other media, but also other games. And so for that experience, they need to be able to talk about, and it's weird to keep talking about you know, the Grey Warden, or they can refer to him by title and you know who they mean, but everyone realizes that, you know, in real life you wouldn't refer to him as the Grey Warden. You would probably use his name at some point, but they can't. There's always the problem between was it male or female, was all this. It changes how subsequent experiences have to be relayed, because the game has to account for the fact that it doesn't really know who the person was. BioWare generally does this by allowing you to tell the game who the previous person was, so at least the gender is consistent. But even then, they can't use the name, absent much more robust speech recognition software that would allow dialogue to be inserted, which we may eventually get to, but we don't have yet. The key to all this is Dragon's Age 2 would be easier to transition into other media, but even then, while you have a name now, you would still have to pick the choices that the hero of... gosh, I want to say Kinrath, but I'm not thinking of Star Wars. Kirkwall, the hero of you would have to settle what his choices were. And that's going to take away from the experience. And so the most successful properties, I think, are the ones who don't try to play off of the experience that the player has and try to play off of the greater narrative. I'm going to use World of Warcraft here. The World of Warcraft novels tend to ignore the player characters. They tend to be about the monolithic figures that are sort of above where the player characters are. The player characters are heroes, but they're not Vol'jin, they're not Thrall, they're not Jaina, whom I loathe as a character, but that's a story for another day. So Warcraft, while the novels are very hit or miss, it's based mostly on writing, the reason they tend to work is that they're not concerned with what the players are doing. They're talking about the things that are motivating the players. And so that accomplishes a couple of goals. One, it prevents all the problems we've just talked about. And two, it means the books feed back into the game because you can use them to explain why you're doing things in the game. It becomes a sort of symbiotic relationship. And so even if the books are not the best written things in the world, the player base will still enjoy them because it gives background and context to the events of the game. That's a way to have a different media. But at that point, again, I would say it's not truly a different media because it's really just a transcript of the story for the game. You're really just giving context for the game. And so it's still not the game succeeding in other media. It's other media being used to reinforce the game. And so you really still aren't seeing an independent take on moving World of Warcraft into the realm of books or the World of Warcraft into the realm of movies. You're seeing books and movies being created to better explain the elements of the game.
And that's a good part to transition to what I think the second biggest problem of games into other media is, how do you treat the game part of the game? I mean, World of Warcraft, you can talk about that you click buttons which push skills, which then have to be done in a certain order, and then cooldowns. I mean, how do you explain that in a way that makes sense in another media? Lord of the Rings, I think, is a good example, where they sort of talk about magic and how magic works, and you can kind of be amorphous about it, and you understand it's something that Gandalf does, and there's forces, but there's not really an explanation of how he developed his skills. But in a game, there's more of an explanation of, well, I have started at level 1, and then I trained at the Wizard's Hut, and then I trained at the Wizard School, then I trained at the Grand Academy, and now I can go from shooting some sparks to shooting like 18,000 lightning bolts. But there's not a good way to explain the gameplay in other media, in movies, in books. I read the Guild Wars transition novels from Guild Wars 1 to Guild Wars 2, and you could see the different writers struggle with, how do I explain the game parts? How do I explain how a necromancer summons a golem? We understand you put a golem skill on the skill bar, and you click it, and bam, a golem appears, and he lays down havoc for 30 seconds and does X amount of damage. And we buy into that because we buy into the game part while we're playing the game. But in seeing that in book form, I mean, how do you explain how a necromancer raises them? How do you explain what happens when a player character dies but gets re-rezzed in the game, but in a way that sort of makes sense in a book?
And I think the simple answer is usually you don't. The Warcraft novels kind of suffer from that too, and that things that involve clicking a button seem so much, you know, more involved and grander when they're kind of written out. But then you think, well, if it's that involved, then how come there are 5 million druids on my server that seem to be able to do the same thing Malfurion can in these books after years and years and years of study? And some of this is, you know, it's understandable. The game doesn't have time to walk you through those steps generally. And so it's not that it doesn't make sense. It's not that it's bad in and of itself. It's just a barrier. And it's a barrier that's not frequently overcome. And when it's overcome, it's not overcome well. And I think that's why we don't see attempts. And the book series I can think of have been, you know, hit or miss. There are books for a lot of games. There are books for, I believe Doom even had a couple of books, which...
I think three.
Yeah, that sounds right. And so it's not that it's not attempted, but it's not attempted a lot in the grand scheme of things, especially in media types that are expensive. Books are comparatively fairly cheap, especially with the advent of ebooks. You know, you can self-publish, you can develop it from fan fiction. Publishers have a way to find out if something is going to sell before they ever sign the book. Movies, of course, being much more involved enterprises, you don't see many of those at all. And I think the Dungeons & Dragons movie kind of explains why that might be. Movies based on niche audiences and gaming audiences. Gamers are very particular, they're very demanding, and they know their stuff. I can find people who would not be able to tell you, name any three battles in the American Civil War, but they will know an entire history of Azeroth, pretty much from the Sundering onward. And that's the way gamers are. And so I think also another reason that that we haven't addressed yet on why do games fail in other media is gamers. We are not really willing to extend a lot of leeway to go to any forum community, don't care which one, pick at random. You're going to find that people are very, very unforgiving on any aspect of the game. And if you go to a good lore forum, you're going to find the same thing there. People will find the inconsistencies. They will find the things that don't make sense. They will find the places that break your story. And this isn't a criticism. I'm like that, but that's just how it works. And so we're not going to cut people a lot of slack. And so you'd say, oh, well, you know, X game has millions of followers, surely a movie would do well. Well, movies need more than any particular game's following to do well, but beyond that, they can't even count on their game's following. In fact, the game's following may be the biggest critics of any other media source that comes out, because they're going to know when you're wrong. Even if you can't technically be wrong because it's a made-up world, they will find a reason that is inconsistent with things you've said before. And so I think gamers are a hindrance to, maybe rightly so, maybe it's we demand quality, but however you want to look at it, again, it's not right or wrong, but I think it is a barrier.
And that is something that I think it's a very solid point, because Steven brought up Into the Darkness, the latest Star Trek movie. And Star Trek fans tend to be that way too. They have very specific expectations about how the characters work. But even then, they're willing to compromise more or less on the new movies and kind of accept Christopher Pine and Zachary Quinto's interpretation of the two main characters of the original Star Trek, Kirk and Spock, to a certain degree, as long as there's more leeway in the quote canon to have different interpretations of the character and there's more buy-in. But gamers, we can look in the mirror and say we can't compromise on anything. We can't compromise on our own game when the game creator himself says, I made a mistake on that and this is what I really meant to say. And we almost burn down the world. Dragon Age is a great example. I mean, setting aside the technical issues and the money grab aspects, which did hurt Dragon Age 2, I mean, there shouldn't be any reason why picking a character and following him in Dragon Age 2 would make a difference in between the two games, but it did. It was something we could not accept. And, I mean, I suffered from this. I could not buy into Kirkwall. I looked at it, I looked at the world, and I was like, this isn't Dragon Age. And that's absurd, because the people who created it created this, but my response is, this isn't right, and I stopped playing for it. And, I mean, that gets into a greater point of we are very fickle, and we'll take a look at a really bad movie, like the Street Fighter movie with Jean-Claude Van Damme. I mean, that is a terrible movie, because it was made to be a Jean-Claude Van Damme vehicle, and said it, and it was bad for that. I mean, it's bad. But let's ask ourselves a question of what would have been better? I mean, in the story of Street Fighter, we have very specific expectations of how Ryu acts and what his powers are, but you can't show that in a believable way on film. You can't show a hurricane kick in a way that's going to look believable when you see a real person performing it. And, I mean, that's part of the reason why the animated Street Fighter series generally are viewed better. But the entire story of Street Fighter in the game is predicated on your success and your failure and your ability to internalize that. And, I mean, Street Fighter is another good example. I mean, people are very critical on the Alpha series because they don't believe the Alpha characters could evolve into the Street Fighter II World Warrior characters that we saw, even though they're made by the same people. Mega Man, same person, making the games. And people are like, I'm not buying into the way you're portraying Mega Man.
And so that it's a barrier to entry. It's a problem for moving these things into other media because you don't have a built-in fan base. You might think you did, but you don't. And in fact, the people who you might say are a fan base may undermine you. And it's the good news is what we've seen going the other direction, which we may talk about at some point in the future, but just to mention it here, other media that have become games, they are also generally bad. Not always. There are some very noteworthy exceptions to that, but oftentimes they're terrible. And again, it comes down to you just don't have the people who enjoyed the movie are not necessarily going to follow you into the game because they aren't gamers. They don't, you know, either they have a misconception about who plays video games, or they just don't like video games, or they don't own the equipment to play the video game. Whatever causes it, you don't have a built-in audience. So you see the same thing from the other side. I actually prefer kind of the way gamers have set this up, in that I don't want a lot of really bad cross-promotional things released, and so I would rather, you know, some of these barriers existed because there needs to be... the experience is better when it has a sort of a clarity of purpose. And oftentimes, the clarity of purpose behind a game is to a set of experiences that are not going to translate. And so you have to start compromising the vision to make it work in another media. Honestly, much as I love everything Chris Roberts has ever done, I feel like this is the problem behind the Wing Commander movie. There was a lack of the clarity, you know, Chris Roberts was the driving vision behind it, but I think he discovered, much to his detriment, that you, even though it felt like he was making movies already because of the cutscenes in the Wing Commander games.
Which were movies.
They were live acted, all that. They were movies, but they weren't a movie. They were broken up by gameplay, and you were involved with the characters, and you fought with them, and you bled with them in a virtual sense. And from the safety of your own couch, but still... You had some involvement there, and that's not going to carry over. And so that's what I mean. Not sacrificing the artistic vision necessarily, although in some sense that's also true, but sacrificing the clarity of purpose that drove those cutscenes as vehicles as part of a larger whole. You can't then take them out, like we said with the Xenosaga DVD. You can't remove them from their context, because even though you enjoyed them all individually during the game, for whatever reason, they don't work by themselves at all. And... That's something that's very hard to overcome, I think. I just think that's going to be a very difficult hurdle, and we should probably be glad that more people don't attempt it, because I think that you're going to see a lot more failures than successes.
And I think that's a good point about the Wing Commander movie, because Wing Commander sort of ties into every last aspect we've already talked about. Wing Commander, we'll just start with 3 and 4. Because that's sort of what drove him to make the Wing Commander movie. Is I film cutscenes, I've made Kilrathi, I've cast Luke Skywalker as the main character, I can make a movie from this game. But first of all, let's look at part of the failures in Wing Commander. The Wing Commander cutscenes were broken off by missions that took about 15 to 30 minutes to complete. You can't show that into a movie, because now you spend a third of your movie on one dogfight. And that's not going to work for pacing in a movie. The second problem you had, which ties into our second problem, of Wing Commander hooks you into the characters because you have their radio chatter. You've killed somebody who tried to kill Maniac. You've killed somebody who tried to kill Hobbs. You fought along with Hobbs and had him save your life, only to betray you later. Sorry, that's a Wing Commander 3 spoiler.
We're way past the statute of limitations on Wing Commander games, so.
Yeah, FYI. But you have built up that relationship over the course of hours of gameplay, which you can't show in a movie. So you have the problem of the mechanics of the way the game work don't translate into a movie. And then lastly, the Kilrathi looked so god-awful in the movie, and the ships looked wrong, and the Freddie Prinze Jr. didn't look like any of the other pilots you've ever seen. And so as gamers, we just had this reaction of, this isn't Wing Commander. I don't know what this is. And, I mean, that was the universal, you know, screaming at the point was like, this isn't Wing Commander. I don't know what it is, but it's made by Chris Roberts, who is the father of Wing Commander. And what he says, by definition, almost has to be Wing Commander.
And, well, that and that gets into the greater conversation to tie it into our previous episodes of what is art.
Right.
You know, the auteur principle of making movies is that behind it, but still the movie means what it means to different people. And so, kind of, for lack of a better, for a less trite phrase, it is what it is. People rejected it because the experience had been created and this didn't match their interaction with the experience to the point they were willing to extend it credibility to view it as a furtherance of the original experience. And so it failed. It wasn't independent. Again, forgive me, Chris. It wasn't Mr. Roberts. It wasn't good enough on its own to be its own space movie, which is what we saw with The War Z, which is a book to a movie. But apparently other people who aren't me liked it enough as its own entity that they were willing to ignore the fact that it had basically nothing to do with the book. And that's fine. Sometimes that happens. Hey, Jurassic Park, great example. Love Jurassic Park the movie. Has nothing to do with the book. There are dinosaurs in both, but that's basically it. And that's fine when you reach that, but it didn't reach that point, and it didn't resonate with its core audience, and so it didn't work.
Well, and Stevens hit the nail on the head on that this isn't a unique problem to games. This has been a problem with translating any media to other media. It's the reason why literary nuts keep asking for the Great Gatsby movie. And can never get it because the movie can never match your expectation of how you read the works. Lord of the Rings aficionados were upset to a great deal for how the movies came out and how Peter Jackson made the translation because he had to make stylistic choices for things that don't that worked in the book but don't work into a movie. Harry Potter. I mean, these are successful franchises, but some of the storylines from the book are better developed, but don't show necessarily in the movie. I think, and this is not a criticism of that, but the Ron Weasley character is much better in the book than he is in the movie. But part of that is because you can spend more time in the book developing his character, explaining why he has the moral failings that he does, and explain how his loyalty works and how Dumbledore always knew that Ron would want to return to Harry and Hermione, but he would have his moral failing first. But in the movies, that can never come through because of time limitations, that he's a secondary character, that it's not necessarily germane for understanding the greater point. But this has constantly been a struggle in artistic media, that art in one media very seldomly translates into another media without radical change to it.
And just as games are, we've talked about, you know, they have basically are often movies with extra components. The more components you have, the more moving parts, the worse the problem becomes. And that's why I think you see more successful movie book sorts of transitions where people are willing to extend some leeway to both than you are with games, because there's one more set of parts that you absolutely can't get into other media. And the closest I can get is, yes, my example of making a choose-your-own-adventure book of a game to try to simulate some sort of gameplay mechanic or interactivity. But that's going to be a very poor substitute. It just doesn't work. And like anything else, when you have more, when you increase complexity, you increase the problems when you try to break it all down and rebuild it. And that's what we see. So again, I think the most successful ones are when you take a whole element that is kind of independent of the game and make it its own thing, but you have to be careful to avoid any of the other elements. And the reason something like Dragon's Age 2, you still have all those mechanistic elements. Who was the Grey Warden? What did the hero of Kirkwall do? How did it end? Those things are not just story elements. They're game mechanic elements. They are related to decisions and the interactivity. You can't touch that. The second you touch the interactivity, you introduce a new set of problems. And so you either have to have a fan base that is very willing to accept that this is not the game at all, or you've got to come up with a way to do things so that in Dragon's Age, they could probably tell another story from Orlais or from some other country in the Dragon's Age world, so long as they, or something from the past, something before these characters existed. Because the lore is there, the stories may be there, but they can't touch the game. And so when I kind of play the semantic game and say we haven't really seen a game successfully transitioned into other media, that's what I mean. You can transition the story because games are often based on these elaborate stories. Sometimes you can do that, but the second you start touching the game, which is a whole package with gameplay mechanics and visual elements and all these other things, you have drastically reduced your chances of a successful transition. And that's why what happened with Wing Commander. There was no way to transition the gameplay elements. It's what will almost inevitably happen with any World of Warcraft movie, that we'll just have to ignore the fact that the PC characters exist. They may be able to make one, but it's going to have to focus, it's going to have to do what the books do, and so severely downplay the player characters that you might as well, that they might as well not exist.
Or Halo, or the often rumored Halo movie with Master Chief. I mean, how do you actually show the gameplay elements of the first Halo? Because some of the story elements were hooks into the way the gameplay worked, to teach you how to operate a Warthog, to get you experience driving the Warthog. That's not going to work in a movie.
No, and so it's not impossible, but the more of the game you actually try to transition, the harder the task is. Hollywood is extraordinarily risk-averse, and so, you know, why do that when you can make the 19th Fast and Furious movie? And so you also have kind of the mechanical obstruction to these sorts of projects, which is no one's really interested in doing something that history has shown us is not super likely to succeed. And so you do. You have the fan base problem, you have the studio problem, you have the simple fact that it's very, very hard to do well. And all of these sort of conspire to make it very difficult to have the kinds of experiences that we want to have in games transition to an experience that we'll enjoy in any other media.
And I think my sort of takeaway from all of this is, as gamers, we need to accept the fact that being able to translate our hobby into other medias does not in any way, shape, or form validate our experience. I think there's sort of a feel that if you can make a movie from a game, then that validates that the game has a story. Or if you can tell a book from a game, then that validates the game has a story. Or it validates that there's an emotional impact. And that's not necessarily true, and that's not a good metric of how you validate that, because it's never been true in any of the course of human history that taking one artistic property from one media to another media and in any way, shape, or form goes back and validates the first one. And I think gaming is not unique in that, and it's not the validation that we often struggle for to legitimize our art can never be defined in the context of making it fit into another media.
Having another art form, having your art form be in another art form, just means that some element transitioned. The validation for art always comes from within the art itself, and so basically, we've got we gamers have our art form, and we don't need validation from anyone else because the work speaks for itself. And for more on that, you can listen to basically any of our previous shows. I think that's a good spot, sort of transition into the second phase of our gaming podcast voyage for today. I'm going to talk a little bit about soundtracks for just a few minutes here. Again, this is all related to phase 4 beta of Final Fantasy is going on, and I'm planning on getting the soundtrack from that, and so I'll kind of start there. Games have always sort of relied on sound. Sound has always been a component. We did a whole show on sound. And the concept of a soundtrack, though, of actually transitioning, in some sense, media into an independent form, into just looking at the sound, has been, as we just spent the better part of 45 minutes describing, something of a tricky proposition. Because a lot of times, game sounds don't work great outside of their context. Nor would sounds from a movie, a sound from any Foley studio, I think I used the right term there, I believe Foley artists are the sound artists for movies, but we won't worry about that right now. They don't work well, but some games do pay a lot of attention to the soundtrack, to the music behind it, just as movies do. And that is an example of where you can almost remove it because you're not touching any of the gameplay elements. For a soundtrack to work, it needs to be music that might have heightened the emotions of the game and played off of them, but is capable of doing its job without any of the other elements. And I think that's why the soundtracks from Final Fantasy, Umetsu's music, has often done so well, is those pieces more feel like they were chosen to complement what was going on than they were driven by it. And what I mean by that is many of the themes that are used could be used for similar situations. They are not intricately tied to that moment in Final Fantasy. They work very well for that moment in Final Fantasy. But you see the same thing in famous music soundtracks for movies. I'm thinking here of Jurassic Park and the John Williams theme to Jurassic Park that most people know, any of the music from Star Wars. Those songs, if you gave them to someone who had not heard Star Wars, would stand on their own. They didn't have to take any of the game elements because they would sort of function independently. And what we've seen is on Steam now, a lot of times Steam will sell the soundtrack for a game separately from the game. And so we are starting to see more of this sort of understanding that well-done music is well-done music, and it can be used to motivate a lot of experiences independently, with or without being tied to a game. A good example of that is the soundtrack to Bastion, which I actually recommend whether or not you ever play the game Bastion, because it had a lot of electronica Western music. It reminded me a lot of Firefly, honestly, sort of that fusion of the Wild West and high technology. And it functioned fairly well. And the songs have a purpose within the story, especially the songs with vocals, Zia's theme. But they work without it. They work as sort of songs around a campfire, whether or not you know what actually happened in the game. And so that was a good choice of a soundtrack to sell. And almost any of the Final Fantasy games, I will be getting the soundtrack to Final Fantasy 14. For anyone who wants to look up the YouTube video or otherwise find the kind of main vocal theme for Final Fantasy 14, it was a fantastic track. Very clearly motivated by events within the game, but it stands on its own because you don't need to understand the reference for the game to kind of understand the emotional impact of what's happening. And so soundtracks are sort of an interesting beast because they combine the best parts. A good soundtrack will be everything we expect from good music, but then in keeping with our theme on games of art, it takes on an even greater aspect when combined with the game. And once you've played the game, some of those feelings will carry over into the soundtrack itself. And so there are basically two reasons to buy soundtracks. Either one, because the music is just that great that it stands on its own. Or two, because it will serve as a sort of auditory device to relive your favorite moments from a game, which there's nothing wrong with that. This basically plays into nostalgia. And so the best soundtracks, I think, are the ones who can be the former, music that stand on its own, but also work as the latter. And that's why I tend to really enjoy re-recordings of Final Fantasy music. The Black Mages, who do predominantly kind of rock covers of various different, a lot of different styles, but mostly rock, of Final Fantasy music, is the music tends to stand well on its own, but it can also be used as sort of an auditory device for recalling some of those shared experiences between people who have played the same game and kind of relive some of those experiences, which can be nice.
And I think Steven hit the nail on the head where the biggest evolution you're seeing in soundtracks is the fact that you have real composers making music. He mentioned Jurassic Park and Star Wars. John Williams is a real composer of music. If he had been born 300 years in the past, he would be writing symphonies, and he would be writing opera soundtracks. So it's not like the concept of the soundtrack is new, but technology has sort of allowed soundtracks to evolve. We've gone from having beeps and boops from an internal PC speaker to 5.1 digital, lossless quality sound ruminating through the room. And a lot of it has to do with, as Steven said, the separate emotional impact. And Final Fantasy is really good about that because you can tell, like, this Final Fantasy song is about sadness. So whether or not you know what you're supposed to be sad about, you can get that sense of sadness, that sense of longing, that sense of loss from just the music itself, and it still moves you emotionally. But then the second step for us as gamers is, you know, that track is, that's Aerith's death track. So now that has added a separate meaning to you. Or one of the examples I always think of is the end song to Portal, with GLaDOS singing it. The song stands on its own. I mean, you could go find anybody and listen to that song, and they'll think it's catchy and clever, and it sounds like a pop song.
At worst, you'd have to explain that it's about a robot, but
right.
Other than that.
And even then, it kind of comes through with the way the voice sounds. But as a gamer, that's summarized the entire plot of the game in one song, in one, 3 minutes of music, and you sort of have that motion. But that's not, that's something that games have been trying to break into forever. The earliest example I can think of is Space Quest III. The two guys from Andromeda got the drummer, I believe, from Supertramp to compose their soundtrack for the game. And all the other games use riffs from that because it set up the iconic Space Quest theme. It set up the iconic theme for the Monolith Burger. And now Space Quest fans demand that there has to be a Monolith Burger in any new Space Quest game because we like the music so much. And so music is a good hook, and soundtracks are evolving. And maybe it did start off as marketing in a certain extent of, I already have the sound, I can just lay it down onto 15 tracks and sell it to you as a collector's edition. But now you're starting to see, as game companies hire real composers, that they actually are composing it as a standalone music piece. I mean, that's has been a way to tell a story forever. I mean, it's what opera is.
And it's of course, huge in Final Fantasy, because if you got on a chocobo and didn't hear some version of a chocobo theme, people would flip out. So you definitely see with these games that have invested heavily in sound and music that the soundtrack becomes even more relevant, because that is the shared experience in some sense, or the shared experience is tied inexorably to the background music. And that's a good thing, because it does give us, you know, some kind of access to outside media, to music. But it also functions very well. You know, music is a very powerful tool for memory. And so, especially when you're trying to view games as art, it definitely helps explain, because the chocobo themes are fine on their own. You know, they're decent enough music. But they mean more if you associate them as completely as a Final Fantasy player will with travel or with concepts of freedom or things like that. To say that, oh, well, it's not that the game is art, the music is art, is false, because the music is different depending on whether or not it's interpreted through the lens of the game. And that's why, again, feeding back into our previous episodes, this is properly understood as the game is art, which may also incorporate something that could also be understood as art on its own. But it doesn't do anything to diminish the value of the game itself as the artistic piece.
And, I think, I mean, the soundtrack is important, and it is an artistic element, and I'm glad to see that it's cooperating more and more with games, and that it's standing on its own, and that Final Fantasy's been this pioneer of, basically, they made an opera out of the music of a telling of a game, and that's maybe a transformation where a game has worked in another media.
A real touring opera, just to be clear. I mean, this is the music of Final Fantasy has gone on tour, has come through my hometown. And, you know, it's a thing. It's out there. Though, interestingly, in that particular concert, they also used visual elements from Final Fantasy to sort of provide context for the music, which was also interesting that they, even then, they decided to do a multimedia experience.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a great time to be alive.
Isn't it just?
And that sort of leads me, not really, but for the sake of the podcast, that transitions to me into gamer conventions. And I kind of want to talk a little bit about the history of things like GamersCon and E3 and back when the Dark Ages, where we had to have gaming magazines explain to us what new and exciting things were coming down, or the Computer Expo show in Las Vegas. That gaming conventions, gaming cons, E3, they're not necessarily about us, the gamer. And I know this seems very counterintuitive with all the media coverage that we receive from this, but we get our news on a daily basis now through the internet. That is for us. That is press releases, previews, all of that. That's where we get our information. But we need to remember that some of these trade shows are just that, they're trade shows. They're an opportunity for developers to talk to other developers about the types of games they're making, about the technology they're making, about seeing how things are developing. And I think through that, it's good for us to take a step back and realize that not all of that needs to be public. Not all of that has to be things we need to know about here and now. And part of me, the little kid inside of me that the older me tries to strangle out, wants to occasionally have the big spoiler come from, or the big reveal come from these gaming conventions. So in some regards, we need to back off a little bit and allow that to happen organically and not realize that every last moment of these conventions needs to be documented for eternity, and that a lot of it's not really even about us.
No, I mean, again, the earliest versions of these were trade shows, just about the technology and trading ideas. I'm glad that we have real conventions now and we're not just sort of a subset of the comic book convention. Not that those aren't great, but they really are two different art forms and two different styles and have two different audiences. A lot of crossover, but the expectations are different. And so I'm a fan of gaming conventions. I think they're great. I tend to read notes from them rather than, you know, buying a pass to be able to see everything that's going on, because I'm sort of more interested in the cliff notes of what happened. For me, it's a lot like sports, which, yes, I'm a gamer who enjoys. But for me, I'm not the biggest fan of watching sports on TV, but I love to be there. And for me, gaming conventions are kind of the same thing. I want to read the cliff notes just like I want to see it on SportsCenter. But barring that, for me, there's no in-between. I either want the cliff notes or I want to be there in the thick of it. And it's a lot of fun. It can be a lot of fun, especially if you go to a convention that you know is going to have people there that you want to see. But, you know, it is marketing. It is a little bit of, you know, razzle-dazzle, a little bit of trade show, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And so don't go totally crazy. Don't buy all the way in. And as far as watching it, you're, like we've been talking so much about how we communicate experiences, the experience of a game convention cannot necessarily be totally accurately portrayed through a video cast. You'll get part of it, but you're not getting the whole thing. And so for me, I don't want part of it. I want either a little bit of it so I know what happened, or I want all of it. And if you find yourself disappointed by sort of the streams or things like that, maybe consider, you know, going to a gaming website afterwards and reading the cliff notes. You may actually enjoy it more, certainly save yourself some time.
Right. And I mean, it's nothing that can be documented. There's no amount of digital media that can put you there. And I think that's fine. I mean, but understand what the conventions are. And understand that for a lot of these developers, this is not a vacation for them. I mean, for us, it's a vacation to go there and see this, but for them, it's still work. And they still have a job to do, and they still need to make contacts. They may even be looking to hire people away from other companies. And that there's a lot of behind-the-scene things of, and the colloquialism is making the sausage. You never want to see how the sausage is made. And realize that a lot of these gaming conventions, a lot of these trade shows are about making the sausage. And accept that for what it is, that there's never going to be any satisfaction coming from that. And like Steven said, reading the notes from these conventions is often the best way to enjoy it, because you get the highlights, and then you sometimes get the pleasant surprise without having everything spoiled, without having to know everything that's there. Like in GamersCon, I don't really want to know everything that Star Citizen is going to say there. I want to see the reveal down the line. I want to have that little bit of mystique about it. I don't need to know every single last project Capcom's looking at. I don't need to know every last project EA's working on. You know, let them have a chance to develop that, and let them have let them have their own pageantry on how they choose to present it to you, instead of demanding everything right away. And that's just my thought. Just accept it as a beauty pageant that game developers are putting on.
An excellent thought it is. And remember, if we go too far down the road of, you know, making this about marketing, they will turn it into pure marketing, and then they will do everything else out of sight. So this is the end outcome. Take it for what it's worth. But I think that's our show.
I think that is our show.
So thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this, our discussions on gaming conventions, soundtracks, and why generally games don't tend to succeed in other media forms. Hope you'll join us next week here on Gamers Footnotes. Again, our email address is gamersfootnotes2s@gmail.com. Next week, we're going to start talking a little bit about gamers. We talked a little bit about gamers and how they can be sort of the quality control and impediment to moving to other media. Next week, we're going to look a little bit at some of the differences between gamers and non-gamers. And the first we'll be looking at is, why do gamers accept things that the general public does not?
I'm looking forward to talking about that. And this is JT signing off.
And this is Steven. And thank you for coming. Have a lovely rest of the day.